1986. Where are the space bees?
What?
Space bees! LT shouted above the music. Where are they? He was drunk, and Jeff and Wendy, too, and their new friend Doran, all of them drunk together. What else could they be on this final weekend before Christmas break? And where else but at the White Horse, which, as far as he was concerned, was the only bar in normal Illinois?
Jesus Christ, Jeff said. Not the bees again.
LT put his hand on the back of Doran's neck, a sweaty neck, and his hand tacky with beer, but he didn't care. He wanted to pull Doran close.
I need to tell you things, he said into his ear,
and Doran laughed, and then they were in a restaurant booth, with the lights bright, Jeff and Wendy across from him, and Doran, tall, sturdy Doran, beside him. LT leaned into his arm woozily.
God, he was handsome. Naturally handsome, almost hiding it. How did they get here?
He concentrated, but his memory of the past 2 hours was a hopscotch, dancing, drinking, shouting, singing, and then the rude, bright lights of last call and a flash of ice and cold. Did Wendy drive? She must have. To here? The 24-hour steak and shake? The traditional sober-up station? He said to Doran,
It's the flowers that make no sense.
Jeff said,
The flowers have no sense.
And Wendy said,
It's that they have sense that makes no sense.
They both laughed. A beat too late, LT realized there was wordplay at work. He forged on.
The blooms of flowers are lures.
The word thick on his tongue.
Scent and shape and color, they all evolved to attract specific pollinators. The bees and butterflies and beetles.
Oh, my, Jeff said.
And you told me he was shy, Doran said. He can get wound up, Wendy said, when he feels comfortable.
Or tipsy,
Jeff said. LT felt tipsy and comfortable. Why hadn't Jeff and Wendy introduced him to Doran before now? Why wait until the last weekend of the last semester LT would be on campus? It was criminal.
A pretty flower isn't just a simple announcement like, here's pollen, LT said. Simple won't do it.
He tried to explain how flowers were in competition. Pollen was everywhere, nestled inside thousands of equally needy plants desperate to spread their genetic material. What was needed was not an announcement, but a flashing neon sign.
The flower's goal, LT said, is to figure out what hummingbirds think are beautiful.
Slow down, hillbilly, Wendy said. Eat something.
Hummingbirds have an aesthetic sense, Doran said. Of course they do. Have I told you about bowerbirds?
Jeff said, guess what his honors thesis is on. And then he was off, yammering about the bowerbirds of Papua New Guinea. The males of the species constructed elaborate twiggy structures, not nests but bachelor pads, designed purely to woo females. The Vogelkop bowerbird set out careful arrangements of color, blue, green, yellow, each one a particular hue. It didn't matter what the objects were. They could be stones or petals or plastic bottle caps even. As long as they were the correct shade. The females could not be coerced into sex. They dropped by the bowers, perused the handiwork, and flew away if they found them substandard. Their choice of mates, their taste in art, drove the males over millennia to evolve more and more specific displays, an ongoing gallery show with intercourse as the prize.
Wait, Doran said. That doesn't mean they're making an artistic choice. Aren't they just instinctually responding to whoever seems like the fittest mate? It's not beauty, per se.
I love per se, Jeff said. Great word.
I've always been fond of ergo, Wendy said. But it is aesthetics, LT said. Beauty's just...
He made explosion fingers.
Joy in the brain, right? A flood of chemicals and What was the word? Fireworks. Neuronal fireworks. We don't logic our way to beauty. It hits us like a fucking hammer.
Ipso facto, Jeff said.
Doran put his arm around LT's shoulder and said, Eat your burger before it gets cold. Then tell me about the space bees.
Ah, he remembered.
The heat of Doran's arm across his neck made his cheeks flush. Doran smelled of sweat and men in speed stick and something else, something LT could almost recall from far back in his brain from a hot afternoon in a Chicago apartment. But the memory slipped the net. He decided to eat. Wendy told the story of her favorite snowmobile accident. Doran, who'd grown up in New Mexico, couldn't believe that Wisconsin teenagers were allowed to ride machines across frozen lakes. LT began to feel a little more sober, but perhaps that was an illusion.
Space bees, he said.
I'm ready, Doran said. Lay it on me. Every one of the invasives we've found, not a single one uses pollination. There's a lot of budding and spores and wind dispersal and...
He waved a clutch of fries.
You know, I've got a fern man at home. It's like 10 feet tall now.
You do?
But LT didn't want to talk about home.
It doesn't matter. It just grows and spreads, spilling out of its pot. But it doesn't require animal assistance.
Actually, he wasn't sure that was true. Didn't the fern survive because of him, because of his family? It had played on their human tendency for anthropomorphism.
Where'd you go, hillbilly? Wendy asked. Sorry, what did you say?
He asked Doran.
I said maybe all the pollinating species died. Maybe, but why colorful flowers and no pollen? There weren't any animals hatching from the space seed, so...
Doran's eyes went wide.
They have to be designed, then.
Exactly.
Wendy nabbed his glass before it tumbled over.
Inside voices, she said. He gets it, LT thought. The aliens could know what Earth's sunlight was like from very far away, even guess the composition of its atmosphere and soil. But they couldn't know what animals would be here, much less humans. So they had to design plants that could propagate without them.
But if they're designed, why are they so overwrought? LT asked. Those huge fucking umbrellas out west, the sponges smothering South America, all of them crazy colorful and smelly and weird. So my real question is,
where are the space bees? Jeff supplied.
Wrong, LT said.
The real question was the one he was born to answer. He'd get whatever degrees and training he needed. He'd go into the field for evidence. He'd write the books to explain it. He'd explain it to Doran.
The question is, why all this needless beauty? What's it all for?
I don't know, but you're beautiful, Doran said. And then, morning. A thumping that wasn't in his head. Or not all in his head.
LT sat up and pain spiked in his skull. Light blasted through half-open blinds. And there, beside him, Doran. Mouth agape, rough-jawed, one arm across LT's waist. Still there. Still real. He wanted to fall back into the bed, pull that arm across his chest. Then the knocking came again, and he realized who was at the front door.
Fuck!
He slipped out from under Doran's arm without waking him, pulled on shorts. Alcohol sloshed in his bloodstream. He closed the bedroom door behind him. The pounding resumed. LT pulled open the front door. His father started to speak, then saw what shape his son was in. Shook his head, suddenly angry. No, angrier.
I overslept, LT said.
Are you packed?
LT turned to look at the living room, and his father pushed past him.
Dad, could you just wait?
He
His father surveyed the moving boxes, only a few of them taped up. The rest were open, half-filled. LT's plan had been to wake up early and finish packing. Everything had to go. Next semester, he'd finish his coursework in the mountains of western New Guinea, collecting data on how birds had adapted to invasives. And now all he wanted to do was stay here, in central Illinois, in this apartment. "Wait for what?" his father asked. "For you?" LT moved between his father and the bedroom. "Give me an hour. Go for lunch or something. There's a diner." "I'll start taking down what's packed. There's snow coming." "No, please, just give me some time." His father looked at the bedroom door, then at his son. His jaw tightened and LT stopped himself from edging backward. He'd lived his boyhood afraid of his father's anger. Power, he learned, came not from blowing off steam, but demonstrating that you were barely containing it. You won by exacting dread, by making your loved ones wait through the silence so long that they yearn for the explosion. "In an hour, I drive away," his father said. 1994. LT didn't relax until they stepped off the plane in Columbus. Doran kept trying to calm him down, to no effect. The entire trip he'd been imagining that some authority would command the pilot to turn around, send them back to Indonesia. A priest would tell them, "Stupid Americans, gays aren't allowed to be parents," and they would yank the infant out of his hands. Then he emerged from the boarding tunnel holding the baby, saw his mother, and they both burst into tears. He eased his daughter into his mother's arms. "Mom, this is Christina. Christina, this is..." "What is it again?" teasing her. "Mimi." She pressed her face close to the tiny girl and whispered, "I'm your Mimi." A tan, smiling man with a tidy black goatee offered his hand.
"Congratulations, LT. You've made your mother very, very happy."
This was Marcus, Mom's brand new husband, 5 years younger than her, at least. His mother at 46 was still lithe and alarmingly sexy. LT hadn't met husband 3.0 before. Didn't know Mom was bringing him. He felt a flash of annoyance that he had to deal with this intruder at this moment, but then told himself to let it go. The day was too big for small emotions. Doran, holding two duffel bags, one in each arm, said, "We made it." LT kissed him. Hard. In New Guinea, they hadn't dared engage in PDA. 18 years to go. Christina nestled like a peanut in the high-tech shell of the car seat. As Marcus drove them home, LT and Doran talked about how dicey the whole process had been. The orphanage, situated about 30 miles from Jayapura, was overcrowded with hundreds of children left there by the crisis. The facility was nominally run by nuns, but most of the staff were local women, who seemed little better off than their charges. LT and Doran had been practicing their Indonesian, especially the phrases involving gift-giving. "We had to bribe everybody, top to bottom," Doran said. "If it wasn't for LT's friend at the university yelling at them, they'd have taken the shirts off our backs." "It's not their fault," LT said. "Their agriculture is wrecked. The economy's crashing. They're starving." "Maybe they should stop chewing those sugar sticks."
"What now?"
his mother asked. He told her how the locals seemed almost addicted to an invasive plant that tasted sweet, but could not be digested. Gut bacteria couldn't break down those strange peptides, and so passed it along through the colon like a package that couldn't be opened. Doran said, "It'd be great for my diet." A joke, but what Doran had seen there had scared him. And even LT, who'd spent months on the island doing fieldwork for his PhD, had been shaken by the rapid decline in the country. Thousands of alien species had been growing in the forests for 2 decades, ignored and unchecked. And suddenly some tipping point had been reached, and those alien plants had reached the cities. The latest was a thread-thin vine that exploded into a red web on contact with flat surfaces. Villages and towns were engulfed by scarlet gauze. In the orphanage, nurses scraped it from the walls, but that only made it worse, dispersing its spores. He and Doran were terrified it was in Christina's lungs. Invasives might be indigestible, but so was asbestos. In the morning, she'd have her first doctor's appointment. Her papers all said she was healthy, without birth defects, and up to date on her vaccinations. But they weren't about to trust an orphanage under duress. Once they reached the apartment, L.T. still couldn't bear to put down his daughter. While Doran mixed formula and made beds and ordered takeout, L.T. fed his daughter, changed her, and then let her fall asleep on his chest. His mother sat beside him on the couch.
"You're going to have to let Doran do more parenting.
He can fight me for her."
"Big talk for the first night. Wait till sleep deprivation hits."
Christina's eyes were not quite closed, her lips parted. Mom had to know that he'd strong-armed Doran into adoption. His last trip to New Guinea, L.T. had been haunted by the abandoned children. Doran had said, "This is crazy, we're not even 30. And L.T. said, "My parents were teenagers when they had me." And Doran said, "You're making my case." But that argument was over forever the moment Doran met Christina.
"You used to look just like that," his mother said. "Milk drunk."
She was 4 weeks old, living through the days of extreme fractions. In another month, she'd have been their daughter for half her life. In a year, she would have been an orphan for only a twelfth of it. And yet those 4 weeks would never disappear. There would always be some shrinking percentage of her life that she'd lived alone, a blot like a tiny spore. He'd read alarming articles about adopted children who'd failed to attach. What if the psychic damage was already done? What if she never felt all the love they were bombarding her with? His mother called Marcus over.
"Sweetie, show them what you brought."
Marcus opened a wooden box lined with cut paper and lifted out a teardrop-shaped dollop of glass, about 8 inches long and 6 inches wide at the base, purple and red and glinting with gold.
"A crystal for Christina," he said. "That is amazing," Doran said. "You made this?"
"Marcus is an award-winning glassblower," his mother said. She tilted her head.
"He made me these earrings."
Of course, L.T. thought. His mother had always loved bower birds. The gift was very pretty and pretty useless. Too heavy for a Christmas ornament and not a shape that could sit upright on a shelf. They'd have to hang it, but not above her bed.
"Which ear is she supposed to wear it in?" L.T. asked.
Marcus laughed.
"Either one. She'll have to grow into it."
When the food arrived, L.T. needed to eat, and he was forced to surrender Christina to Doran. His body moved automatically as he held her, a kind of sway and jiggle that soothed her.
"Where did he learn that?"
Mom said,
"Did you call your father?"
And like that, the spell was broken. L.T. said,
"What do you think?"
"I think you should."
"Fuck him."
"Hey," Doran said.
"Right, I gotta stop swearing. F that guy."
"Your mom's right. We should give him a chance."
"Hey, he's had 6 years of chances.
Anytime he wants to call, I'll pick up." There were a few years after college when they talked on the phone, and his father would pretend that L.T. lived alone. He never asked about Doran or about their lives. Then L.T. sent his father an invitation to the commitment ceremony. The next time L.T. called, his father said he was disgusted and didn't want to talk to him until he fixed his life. His mother said,
"This is different. Maybe it's time."
"Maybe." He got up from the table. Time itself had become different. He looked at Christina in Doran's arms and thought, "I'm going to know you for the rest of my life." The future had broken open, his week-by-week life suddenly stretching to decades. He could picture her on the first day of school, on prom night, at her wedding. He caught a glimpse of her holding a baby as tiny as she was at that moment. Had his father felt that way too when he was born? He kissed Doran's cheek,
then bent over their daughter. She was awake, dark-eyed, watching both of them. He thought, there's no way I can go away for 6 months into the jungle and leave her. He wouldn't make the choice his parents had made.
We'll give it a shot,
LT said. He moved his cheek across her warm head, inhaled her scent. Won't we, my darling? 2007. He was reading to Christina and Carlos when the call came. Or rather, Christina was reading while LT held the book, because Christina said he was only allowed to do the Hagrid and Dumbledore voices. Carlos, 5 years old, lolled at the end of the bed, seemingly oblivious, but missing nothing. Doran came to the bedroom holding the cordless.
Some guy wants to talk to you. He says he's a friend of your father's.
The thick Tennessee accent opened a door to his childhood. Vernon Beck, hearty as ever. He apologized for bothering LT up there in D.C., but he was worried about LT's father.
He stopped coming to work. He didn't quit, just stopped coming. Same with church. He won't answer the phone at all.
Is he sick? Did he get hurt at the yard?
I went over there, and he finally came out to the porch. He said he was fine, just wanted folks to leave him alone. I don't know, it ain't like him.
They talked a few minutes more. Mr. Beck apologized again for bothering him, explained how he got his number from a cousin. LT reassured him that it was all right. Asked about his son Hale, who turned out to be doing fine, still in Maryville, working maintenance for the hospital. Had a wife and 4 children, all boys. LT thought about that day they ran from the thistles. Funny how you don't know the last day you'll see someone. He'd spent the rest of that winter, when he was 13, daydreaming about Hale, his first big crush. He didn't mention that to Mr. Beck, and Mr. Beck didn't ask about LT's husband or children. Southern silence.
One more thing, Mr. Beck said. Your dad, he's let things go. You should be ready for that.
Doran asked, what happened to your father?
Maybe nothing, but I think I have to go lay eyes on him.
Christina said,
I want to lay eyes on him.
Me too, kiddo. Doran said, but not like this.
Can we read now?
Carlos asked. Doran didn't want LT to travel south. All those famine refugees landing in Florida, and the citizen militias in Texas and New Mexico. LT said his Department of Agriculture credentials would get them through any checkpoint. And besides, Tennessee was nowhere near the trouble.
It's like going into Wisconsin, LT said, quoting one of their favorite movies.
In and out. Fine, Doran said. But why not just call the local police? Let them check it out. But LT didn't want to embarrass Dad or get him fined if he wasn't taking care of the house.
I owe him this much, LT said.
And Doran said, you think so?
Doran stayed home with Carlos, and LT and Christina left before sunrise the next morning, with a cooler full of food so they wouldn't have to depend on roadside restaurants.
Christina fell asleep immediately, slept through all the phone calls he made to the department, and woke up outside of Roanoke. He put away the phone and they listened to music, and he pointed out invasives and native plants alongside the interstate. They were driving through the battlefield of a slow-motion war. Old native species were finding novel ways to fight the aliens, sucking resources from them underground, literally throwing shade above. And new invasives kept popping up into ecological niches.
It's all happening so incrementally, he told her. It's hard to see.
Like global warming,
Christina said. He let her read the opening chapter of the book he was working on, and had taken her to see the Al Gore movie so she understood boiling frogs. This had been his job for the past decade at the Department of Agriculture, explainer-in-chief, interpreter of policy, sometimes influencer of it. He missed the fieldwork, longed to do original research again, but the government desk job provided stability for his family. Remember what I told you about animal speed? He said. Plant speed and planet speed. That's just a hard time scale for us mammals to keep our attention on.
I know. Wheels within wheels.
Exactly. After a day of driving and a 2-hour wait for inspection at the Tennessee border, they entered the foothills. His hands knew the turns. He remembered the long drive home that last day of college and realized for the first time that his father must have had to leave the hills at 1 a.m. to get to Illinois State by noon and then had turned around and driven all the way back the same day. Drove it in silence with a hungover, secretly heartbroken boy sulking in the passenger seat. They pulled into the long gravel drive and parked beside the house. Christina said,
You used to live here?
Be nice. Your grandfather built this house.
No, it's cool. It looks like a fairy castle.
His childhood home was being overrun in the same slow, grasping process that had swallowed Christina's village. The backyard grass, ordinary and native, had grown knee-high. But covering the wall of the house was a flat-leafed ivy, brilliant and slick-looking, as the heart of a kiwi fruit. Definitely an invasive. Was this war or détente? Ivy also covered the back door. He tore away a clear space and knocked. Knocked again. Called out, Dad, it's LT. He tried the door and swung it open. Wait here, he said to Christina. He didn't want her to see anything horrible. The kitchen lights were off. There were dishes in the sink, a pair of pots on the stove. He called for his father again. His toe snagged on something. A vine snaking across the floor. No, many vines. He stepped into the living room and froze. Ivy covered everything. A carpet of green clung to the walls. The fireplace burst with green foliage, and the tall stone altar of the chimney had become a trellis. Vines curled through doorways, snaked along the stair rails. Greenish sunlight filtering through the leaf-covered windows made the room into an aquarium. The air was jungle-thick and smelled of fruiting bodies. He stepped closer toward the fireplace, spied dots of white and red nestled into the leaves. Was the ivy blooming?
What are you doing here?
LT startled. The voice had come from behind him.
Dad?
His father sat in his armchair, nestled into the vines. Leaves draped his shoulders like a shawl. He wore a once white UT Vols sweatshirt that seemed too big for him. His hair was shaggy, a steel gray that matched the stubble on his face. He looked too thin, much older than he should. LT felt as if he'd been catapulted through time. He hadn't seen or spoken to this man for almost 20 years, and now he wasn't even the same person. His father said, Who's this? LT thought, Oh, God, not Alzheimer's. And then realized that Christina had come into the room. She was looking up at the walls, the high ceiling, slowly turning to take it all in.
Dad?
Her voice was strange.
It's okay, honey. There's nothing to be...
This is awesome.
She lifted her hands to her head as if to contain the shock. A sound like applause erupted around the room. The leaves were shaking. She looked at the corner, then up.
Dad, do you see it?
He could. A green shape against the green. Enmeshed in leaves, an oak-thick stalk rose up in the corner. At the top, a bulbous head, a yard wide, was bent against a cross-timber, so that it seemed to be looking down at them. Its right arm stretched across the room, where broad leaves splayed against the wall as if holding it up. Its other arm hung down. Finger leaves brushed the floor.
Holy fucking Dad! Christina chided.
She walked toward the plant, lifted her hands above her head. The leaves of its arms rattled like 100 castanets. She laughed and bent at the waist. Slow-mo's huge head eased left, then right. LT's father said,
"Isn't he a lovely boy?"
Geological time, plant time, animal time. And inside that, yet another, smaller wheel, spinning fast. His father's body had become a container for cells that lived and replicated and mutated at frightening speed. On the second morning, at Blount Memorial Hospital, Christina sat at the edge of her grandfather's bed, curled her fingers around his, carefully not disturbing the IV tubes taped at the top of his hand, and said,
"I read a pamphlet about colon cancer. Would you like me to tell you about it?"
His father laughed.
"Are you going to be a scientist like your father?" He was remarkably cheery, now that equipment had rehydrated him and delivered a few choice opioids.
She shook her head.
"I want to be a real doctor."
LT, listening to on-hold music on his cell, said, "Hey." Doran came back on the line. "Okay, I got him an appointment with Lynn's oncologist. Bring him here. I'll move Carlos into Christina's room." "Are you sure about this?" "I would only do this for my favorite person. Besides, I don't think anybody else is stepping up. You're an only child, right?"
Kind of.
He'd have to explain later. He gave Christina a five and told her to sneak some ice cream into the room. "He likes Rocky Road, but chocolate will do." His father watched her go.
"She reminds me of your mother."
LT thought, "Sure, this tiny, dark-haired, brown-skinned girl, so much like your blonde, dancer-legged wife."
"I mean it," his father said. "When she looks at me, it was like that with Belinda. That light.
Dad,
all the boys in that school, and she chose me."
"Dad, I need to tell you some things."
"I'm not leaving the house."
"You can't go back there. I had Mr. Beck check it out. There are roots running through the floorboards, wrapped around the pipes. The wiring's been shorted out. You're lucky the place didn't burn down."
"It's my house. You can't tell me."
"No, it's Moe's house now. It's been his for years." 2028. On that last Thanksgiving he hosted in the Virginia house, the topic of conversation was, appropriately enough, food.
"We haven't published yet, but the data's solid," Christina said. "We've got an eater."
Cheers went up around the table.
"Were you using cyanobacteria?"
LT asked. Just a few months ago, her gene-hacking team at McGill was making zero progress.
"Or one of the Rotafitta?"
"Let the woman speak,"
LT's mother said. Christina, sitting beside her, squeezed her arm and said,
"Thanks, Mimi."
"She needs no encouragement,"
Christina's husband said, and Carlos laughed.
"Here's the amazing thing. We didn't engineer it. We found the bacteria in the wild, evolving on its own."
"You're kidding me," LT said.
Christina shrugged.
"It turns out we should have been paying more attention to the oceans."
LT tried not to hear this as a rebuke. As the USDA's deputy secretary, he orchestrated the research grants, helped set the agenda for managing the ongoing crisis. It was a political job more than a scientific one, and much of the time the money had to go into putting out fires. So even though everyone knew that most of the seeds had gone down in water, the difficulty in retrieving them meant that almost all the research on water-based invasives focused on ones near the surface. The white pods, like bloated worms, floating in Lake Superior. The fibrous beach balls bobbing in the Indian Ocean. The blue fans that attach themselves to Japanese tuna, like superhero capes. Christina said that the bacteria were found feeding on rainbow mats. The scientific community had missed the explosion of translucent invasives hovering in the ocean's photic zone until they linked and rose to the surface in a coruscating, multicolored mass. The satellite pictures of it were lovely and terrifying. The alien plants were so efficient at sucking up carbon dioxide, in a few decades of unrestricted growth, they could put a serious dent in global warming, while maybe killing everything else in the ocean. But somehow, fast-evolving Earth organisms were trying to eat them first, or at least one species of them. But if one Earth organism had figured it out, maybe others had too.
You have to tell us how they're breaking down those peptides, LT said.
Or not, Carlo said. I have a story, said Bella, Christina's 4-year-old daughter. During craft time, this girl, Neva, it was a disaster.
Wait your turn, darling, Aaron said.
Christina's husband was a white man from Portland. He ran cool to Christina's hot, which was good for Bella. Through some quasi-Lamarckian process, LT's children and his children's children had inherited his most annoying conversational tendency. On Thanksgiving, they didn't go around the table saying what they were thankful for, but rather took turns explaining things to each other. Nothing made LT happier. All he wanted in the world was this, to be surrounded by his family, talking and talking. Much of the world was in dire shape, but they were rich enough to afford the traditional dry turkey breast, the cranberry sauce with the ridges from the can, sweet potato casserole piled with a layer of marshmallow.
You know what this means, Christina said. She caught LT's eye. Next year we'll be eating sugar sticks, like the aliens did.
Perhaps only LT understood what she meant. Homo sapiens are only 10% human. Most of the DNA in their bodies comes from the tiny flora that they carry inside themselves to digest their food and perform a million tiny tasks that keep them alive. If humans could someday adopt these new bacteria into their microbiome, a host of invasives could become edible. It would be the end of the famine. She saw the wonder in his face and laughed.
Wheels within wheels, Dad.
After dinner, the urge to nap descended like a cloud, and only little Bella was immune. Carlos offered to take her to the park, but LT said he would like that honor.
Where the slides are?
She asked. All the slides, he said. Just let me tuck in Mimi. He led his mother to the master bedroom, which was on the ground floor and had the best mattress. She moved carefully, as if hearing faint music in the distance. But at 80, she was still sharp, still beautiful, still determined to stay up with fashion. Her hair was 3 different shades of red.
85 outside, she said, and in here it's a Chicago winter.
I'll get an Afghan, he said, and opened the closet. When he turned around, she was sitting on the edge of the bed, one hand out on the coverlet.
You must miss Doran.
The knot that he carried in his chest tightened a fraction. He nodded.
It's not fair, she said. All our men dying so young.
Arnaud's still alive, LT said. At least he was last year. He sent me a Christmas card.
Good God, what an asshole, she said. It's true what they say, then.
I was the teenage asshole. I don't know how anybody put up with me. She lay down and folded her hands across her chest like Cleopatra. He spread the Afghan so that it covered her feet.
This is a lovely house, she said.
It's too big for me now, unless you move in.
I prefer living on my own these days. I do my painting in the nude, you know.
You do not.
But I could. That's the point.
Bella was waiting for him by the front door.
Papa!
Ciao, Bella. She jumped into his arms. It was a pleasure to be someone's favorite person again, at least for the moment. Ready for the slides? He wished she didn't live so far away. He wished he wasn't so busy. People were making noises about nominating him for secretary. But he could say no, get off the treadmill. He could move to Canada and be close to Christina and Aaron and Bella. Finally finish the book. Make one more research trip,
He'd like to visit New Guinea again, see how the land of his daughter was faring. 53 years after the meteor storm, and there were still so many questions to answer, and so many new things to see. He carried Bella out into the Virginia heat. Soon, he'd have to put her down, but he wanted to carry her as long as he could, as long as she let him.
So, he said to her, what's all this about a disaster at craft time?
2062. The house was full of strangers. They kept touching his shoulder, leaning down into his face, wishing him happy birthday. 97 was a ridiculous age to celebrate, not even a round number. They thought he wouldn't make it to 98, much less 100. They'd probably been waiting for years for him to kick off, and this premature wake was the admission of their surrender. A tiny gray-haired woman sat beside him. Christina.
You have to see this, she said.
She held a glass case, and suspended inside it was a glossy black shape flecked with silver.
It's from the current Secretary of Agriculture. For 45 years of service to the nation and the world.
This one came from Tennessee. You remember telling me about Mimi finding a seed? There was an ocean of days he couldn't remember, but that day he recalled clearly.
Rockhound's delighted, he said softly.
What's that, Dad?
Ah. The strangers were watching, waiting for a proper response. He cleared his throat and said loudly,
So have those alien bastards shown up yet?
Everyone laughed. The afternoon stretched on interminably. Cake, singing, talking, so much talking. He asked for his jacket, and a familiar-looking stranger brought it to him, helped him out of his chair.
I have to tell you, sir, your books made me want to be a scientist. The Distant Gardener was the first...
LT lifted a hand.
Which way is the backyard?
He could still walk on his own. He was proud of that. Outside, the sky was bright, the air too warm. He didn't need his coat after all. He stood in a garden surrounded by towering trees. But whose garden? Whose house? It wasn't his home in Virginia. That was long gone. Not Chicago or Columbus. Was this Tennessee? Everything moves too fast, he thought, or else barely moves at all.
Papa?
A young woman holding the hand of a little girl. The girl, just 3 or 4 years old, held a huge black flower whose petals were edged with scarlet.
Ciao, Bella,
he said to the girl. The woman said,
No, Papa, this is Annie. I'm Bella.
A stab of embarrassment. And wonder. Bella was so old. How had that happened? How had he gotten so far from home? He wanted to do it all over again. He wanted Doran's shoulder next to him, and tiny Christina in his arms. He wanted Carlos on his shoulders at the National Zoo. All of it again.
It's okay, Papa,
Bella said. His tears concerned her. What a small, common thing to worry about. He inclined his head toward the little girl.
My apologies, Annie. How are you doing this afternoon? Did you fly all the way from California?
She let go of her mother's hand and approached him.
I have a flower.
Yes, you do.
It's a pretty flower.
It certainly is.
Bella said,
She likes to tell people things.
The girl offered the flower to him. Up close, the black petals seemed to ripple and shift. Their dark surfaces swirled with traceries of silver that caught the light and spun it prettily. He raised it to his nose and made a show of sniffing it. The little girl laughed. Words were not required. Sometimes the only way you could tell someone you loved them was to show them something beautiful. Sometimes, he thought, you have to send it from very far away.
Where did you find this lovely flower?
He asked. She pointed past his shoulder. He could feel the tower of green behind him.
The leaves were about to move.